Give me an F. Give me an I. Give me a... Oh, never mind. That's going to take way too long. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another fantastic episode of Amelia's Weekly Fish Fry, brought to you by EEJournal.com and hosted by me, Amelia Dalton. Folks, we have so much ground to cover this week. We've got a Kobol update, we've got adventures and interconnects, and we even have some tiny rats driving around in tiny cars. And I know you want me to start with that last one, right? Now, I don't know about you, but I love driving. I may not be the best driver in the world, but I really love that open road. Someday, I hope to drive all the way across the United States in my dream car, a powder blue 1957 Chevy Ragtop. Yeah. And apparently, we aren't the only mammals on the planet that love to drive. Funny thing, rats do too. So a recent study at the University of Richmond in Virginia found that not only can rats learn to drive, but driving can also improve their cognitive function, help to sharpen their ability to learn complex tasks, and reduce their stress. Driving reduces stress in rats. Welcome to 2020, y'all. So, are these little dudes driving around in little 57 Chevys? No, not exactly, but that would be adorable, wouldn't it? This team at the University of Richmond actually created what they refer to as ROVs, or rodent-operated vehicles, which are basically a plastic food container on wheels with an aluminum floor and three copper bars that work as a steering wheel. The rats then stand on that aluminum floor, grip the copper bars with their paws, and that then completes an electrical circuit that propels the car forward. When the rats touch the left, center, or right bar, the car would then be steered into those directions. I hear you loud and clear. That's cute and all, Amelia, but these are rats. How did they really learn to drive these little electric plastic jars? Sure, I'm with you. There's a host of skills required here that you wouldn't really consider as rat-worthy. But with some practice and some sugary cereal rewards, Fruit Loops to be exact, these rats were able to navigate around in their enclosed areas. But not all of the rats in this study were the best drivers. You see, the group of 11 rats tested in this study were divided into two groups. The ones that had an enriched environment with toys and a natural-ish habitat, and the rest that did not. And funny thing, the group of rats that had that enriched environment not only performed better at their driving test, but also were way more interested in the car itself, even after being rewarded with said Fruit Loops. But what about that stress part? So in addition to creating these tiny little adorable cars for their rats to drive in, this team of researchers also studied the amount of two specific stress-related hormones in the rats' droppings: corticosterone, which is a marker for stress, and DHEA, which controls stress. And you know what they found? Levels of both of these hormones decreased in all of the rats studied during the course of their tiny driving lessons. And get this, this team also found that the rats that drove themselves had lower hormone levels as well, and were way less stressed than the rats that were driven around as passengers in remote-controlled cars. Dr. Kelly Lambert, study author and professor of behavioral neuroscience at the University of Richmond, sums up the study like this. It reminds us that we can use challenging tasks with preclinical animal work to learn more about human challenging behavior and cognitive systems. So besides the adorable factor here, which is pretty high, this group at the University of Richmond is hoping that this rat racing research can help us better understand neuropsychiatric conditions in humans. Dr. Lambert points out that this study could help pave the way for more tests to probe the effects of Parkinson's disease on motor skills and spatial awareness, or even the effects of depression on motivation, all by outfitting rats in tiny plastic cars. Okay. All right, let's head into the world of interconnects, shall we? Now, we all want faster copper. We all want higher density optics. We all want our digital cake and eat it too. I get it. But what is really going to help us keep pace with the next generation of embedded computing? Standards. Please welcome Mike Walmsley from TE Connectivity. We're talking about the forces driving a need for standardization in interconnects, what the next generation of interconnects looks like, and how fiber fits into this whole business. Let's go. My guest today is Mike Walmsley from TE Connectivity. Hey, Mike, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Okay. So first off, what's your role at TE?
My role is actually shifting a little bit out of product management into industry standards and portfolio direction. So I'm helping support my product management group that I was part of and identifying trends and where we have opportunities.
All right. Well, let's talk about interconnect standards in particular and keeping pace with the embedded computing industry. So, Mike, what's driving the need for standardization in interconnects in particular?
So it goes back a ways. VPX started in early 2000s as an effort trying to make common platforms and common computing modules and make sure different manufacturers' components were interoperable with each other to develop systems. That's taken a whole new level of effort right now with the SOSA organization, the SOSA consortium, driving standardization from the military branches up through the entire industry. So there's a real focus on identifying key platform architecture and configurations that are carry across multiple programs and applications.
So from a VITA interconnect standard standpoint, how did we get to where we are now?
VITA, VPX, like I said, started in around 2006. The standards were released around then. A lot of work had been done ahead of that. That started with the original VPX connector, which is our multi-gig connector as a backplane interconnect. And the framework was identified back then. And since then, we've done mezzanine interfaces for XMCs and FMCs. We've added RF and optical modules. And really, in the last 5 years, it's been a significant effort to develop higher density RF, higher density optics, faster copper, really taking all those building blocks and making them ready for the next generation of products.
So, Mike, where are we going from here? What does the next generation of these standards look like?
So there's a few key trends that we're chasing. One, from an interconnect standpoint, we need to keep up with all the protocols and the trends in higher speed. So we've released product last year, our multi-gig RT3 connector, which supports 100 gig Ethernet, has 425 gig lanes, can run through that connector. 200 gig Ethernet is right around the corner, PCIe Gen 5. So our customers, our industry is really driving copper to higher speeds. Similarly, in the optic side, we're working on 10 gig applications today. There's 25 gig transceivers coming, and the infrastructure really around the interconnect needs to keep up with speed. In addition, there's 6U and 3U VPX cards. 6U's considerably larger, and there's been a real push and a migration to get down to 3U levels, and the components and the processor and everything allows that to happen, which puts more burden on the interconnect within that small space to get all that I/O throughput and the RF and the optics and everything else through that channel. So a lot of our efforts will continue to move forward on getting more out of a smaller space and what new interconnects and how many more IOs can we add to it without expanding the package.
So Mike, as we head to these higher and higher speeds, when is the transition to fiber going to come and can copper keep up with us?
So fiber is actually happening now. There's more and more design activity. We're launching a lot of new products. The MT interface is not just inside the box as a plug-in module to backplane interface, but it's getting carried outside the box as well. So we're starting to see that growth in optics. It's still considerably more expensive than copper. And we continue to develop copper for the next generation speed. So while we introduced RT3, we are in development already on next-gen solutions and looking at other interconnects that serve other industries that we've already know can meet those speed levels and can they be ruggedized for our markets.
Cool. All right, Mike, it is time for your off-the-cuff question now. If you had one person alive or dead to have dinner with right now, who would it be?
It would be Genghis Khan. I recently read a children's book that my six-month-old grandson has that his parents bought him about leaders in industry. And there's a couple pages on Genghis Khan, and it just makes me want to read more about him and learn more about his life.
Great answer, Mike. Well, I think that's all I have time for today. Thank you so much for joining me yet again.
Before we go, I have an update to a story that I ran a couple weeks ago.
On April 10th, I reported on the shortage of COBOL-trained engineers. Yes, that COBOL, that was put out to pasture more than a couple decades ago, and that you probably only know from a textbook, a rumor, or maybe a hieroglyph on an ancient mainframe. And since that story ran earlier this month, there have been some positive movements in this space. So if you weren't aware, a dozen states are still using COBOL in some capacity, including New Jersey, California, Rhode Island, and Iowa. And a lot of times, the COBOL in question is being used in some very important government programs, like unemployment insurance. And sadly, most of the world's COBOL programmers are retired, or have rightly moved on to more modern languages. Well, now IBM and the Linux Open Mainframe Project have gotten together to help states navigate this COBOL craziness with three new incentives. The Calling All COBOL Programmers Forum, the COBOL Technical Forum, and the Open Source COBOL Training Program. So first, that Programmers Forum. This is actually a portal where employers can connect with available and experienced COBOL programmers. So anybody with time on their hands, or those of us looking for employment, or retired skilled veterans, even students who have successfully completed COBOL courses, or professionals just wanting to volunteer. Next, the COBOL Technical Forum. Think of this as a COBOL hotline of sorts that is monitored by experienced COBOL programmers, providing free advice and expertise during this crisis. Also, keep in mind, with this tool, it will help all levels of programmers manage issues, learn new techniques, and expedite solutions if needed. And finally, the Open Source COBOL Training Program, which is a brand new open source course designed to teach COBOL to beginners and experienced professionals alike. Now, IBM worked with a host of clients to develop an in-depth COBOL programming with VS Code course that is absolutely free. And even better, this curriculum will also be made into a self-service video course with hands-on labs and tutorials available via Coursera and other learning platforms next month, and will also be available on IBM's own training platform free of charge. So if you're bored and you really want to help our country unravel this COBOL mess, I've included a host of links below the player on this week's Fish Frying page on eejournal.com. Hey, have you checked out EE Journal on social media yet? Well, you should. You can find us at facebook.com/EEJournal. If you're into Twitter, you can monitor our tweets at EEJournalTFM. And don't forget, if you want to follow my personal Twitter account, check out AmeliaD1978. And if LinkedIn is more your thing, well, sure, you can follow us on LinkedIn as well. We also have a YouTube channel, youtube.com/EEJournal. Folks, it is chock full of all kinds of techie videos, including our very popular Chalk Talk webcast series, hosted by yours truly. And by clicking the links below the player on this week's Fish Frying page, you can check out the Fish Fry archive, or subscribe to Fish Fry via Podbean, Spotify, or the iTunes Store. And remember, if you want any further information about the stories covered in today's show, just head on over to eejournal.com and look for this week's Fish Frying page. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you know of any cool new technology, or if you just want to chat, send me an email at amelia@eejournal.com, or post a comment on our forums on EE Journal. For the week of May 1st, 2020, I'm Amelia Dalton, and you've been fried.